Would you join me in Matthew chapter 16? The Gospel of Matthew chapter 16. It took Thomas Edison more than 1,000 tries to invent the light bulb. When he finally succeeded, a reporter asked him the question, "What does it feel like to have failed 1,000 times?" Thomas Edison famously responded, "I didn't fail 1,000 times. I found 1,000 ways not to make a light bulb." And it's a good thing he looked at it that way, because when it came to inventing the alkaline battery, for example, Thomas Edison wouldn't fail 1,000 times or 2,000 times. That would take him more than 10,000 different attempts. Later in life, he would go on to say, "Our greatest weakness lies in giving up. Most certainly, the way to succeed is always to try just one more time." And that's because when we're chasing goals, when we're chasing objectives in life, when we're pursuing those things, challenges will come up. It takes the willingness to keep on going even when all the odds are against you. That's what one man decided to do on his journey in life. At 22 years old, he failed in business, went out of business, went bankrupt. At 24, he failed again in business. At the age of 26, his girlfriend died. At the age of 27, he almost went crazy. At the age of 29, he was defeated in an election. He was defeated again at age 31, age 34, age 39, age 46, age 47, age 49. But by the time Abraham Lincoln was 51 years old, he was elected President of the United States. The point is this. When a person is chasing something, whatever that thing may be, it won't always be easy. And as my dad often used to say, if it is easy, it's probably not worth very much. Well, when it comes to chasing and to pursuing God's plan for your life, that will take persistence. That will take a willingness to keep on going, even in the face of obstacles and challenges. Sometimes I hear people say something like, "Well, if it's God's will, it'll all just work out. It will all just fall into place." And I understand what they're saying, that God will open doors and such in our life. But I do have to say, I don't agree with the language, because just being God's will for our life does not mean it will be easy. It doesn't mean we will never face challenges. It will take dedication. It will take perseverance. It will sometimes take 10,000 tries before we finally succeed. The Apostle Paul knew all about challenges in ministry. Listen to what he said about his ministry challenges in 2 Corinthians 11. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews 40 lashes less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. I was stoned, I was shipwrecked, I was in danger from robbers and thieves, from my own people, from false believers, and on his list goes. In the very next chapter of 2 Corinthians, he says, "A thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me. 3 times I pleaded with God about this, that it should leave me, but he said, 'My grace is sufficient for you.'" In other words, no. Paul, that challenge, that obstacle, that difficulty will remain. And yet, even though Paul had difficulty after difficulty and challenge after challenge and setback after setback, he still says in Philippians 3, "I press onward to the goal." Make no mistake about it. In God's plan for your life, you will have things to overcome. There will be obstacles. There will be setbacks. There will be days that you feel you're not as good as the day before, and days when you feel great. It will all happen. And sometimes the setbacks we encounter can come from the world. They can come from our enemy, the devil. But it surprises people to hear they can oftentimes come from those we know. It can come from family. It can come from friends. It can come from people that we've trusted to advise us in life. And that's what we see happening here in Matthew 16. Jesus is on a mission for the ministry God has sent him for. And in the middle of that pursuit, in the middle of that journey, we see an obstacle. and an obstacle that comes from a very surprising place. Notice what it says in verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." You might have noticed that verse 21, the beginning of this passage, where it says, "From that time Jesus began," it seems that verse is actually pointing our attention backward to the passage just before it. And it's important to recognize, because that passage is perhaps one of the greatest in all of the Bible, because it's in that passage we get something that would later and forever be called the Great Confession of Peter. It was the first time in history that anybody ever confessed Jesus Christ as being Lord of all. And it says in verse 15, Jesus said to them, the disciples, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter. And on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." Contrary to some popular belief, Jesus is not saying the church would be built on Peter. Because actually the Greek word Peter, Petros, literally translates to pebble. And rock, in the language Jesus is using, is literally the top of a mountain. And so it's almost as if Jesus is saying, "Peter, you are a pebble of a man, but you have confessed a mountain of truth. And it's on that truth, the truth of Jesus' deity, the truth that he is God, on that rock, he will build his church." That confession comes just moments before the passage we're in. Probably part of the same conversation. And it's interesting how it compares that he goes from saying, "You're Christ, the Son of the living God," to verse 22, where he said, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." And in that single statement, Peter will go from hero to zero. Because he goes from affirming Jesus' ministry to becoming the number one obstacle to it. And oftentimes, that's how our enemy works. He will take people close to us, people we know well, and even often without them even knowing it, he will use their words and twist their meaning to try and cause us to doubt God's call on our life. And doubt is one of the most powerful tools the enemy possesses. And I say that because doubt eliminates trust. And therefore, doubt eliminates faith. You remember what James said in chapter 1. "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God. But let him ask in faith with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind." You can look at your faith as the cement that anchors you. And the only thing in your life with the power to break that is doubt. So for a believer, doubt is like kryptonite to our faith because it removes trust. And if we don't have trust, we don't have faith. And if we don't have faith in Christ, none of the rest even works. If you've ever seen somebody working on a telephone pole, you'll understand what I mean when I say they wear a lot of gear when they go up there, don't they? A harness and a helmet, and they've got ropes and straps. And I got to talk to a man who was working on a telephone pole one time, and he was explaining to me that all of that gear obviously is there to keep them from falling, but the only way it works is when you put all of your weight in that harness. Because the weight of the climber causes the ropes to bind. And it causes the clamps to work and the straps to get tight. And the harder you pull, the tighter it gets. He said, there's no danger in trusting the harness. The danger comes when you don't. Because if you don't trust your gear, you won't put enough weight on it. And if you don't put enough weight on it, the ropes can slip and the straps can slide. And it's more dangerous to doubt the gear than to put 100% faith in it. And the same is true for our faith and our relationship with Jesus. Doubt is far more dangerous than total trust. Doubt has the power to kill trust. And it isn't that doubt is inherently that powerful. Because truthfully, faith is multitudes more powerful than doubt. You've heard the saying before that goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. In other words, a little prevention is worth more than all of the cure you could possibly imagine. Well, Jesus said that faith the size of a mustard seed could move a mountain. Your faith is more powerful than doubt. Faith has the power to push back an ocean of darkness, and your enemy knows that. He knows all it takes is a little faith, and he loses control of that life forever. And so he takes a gallon of doubt with the intention of quenching a single spark of faith. And he tries to drown us in that doubt, hoping that faith won't spark, won't ignite, won't take root. And so he uses people closest to us, often without them even knowing what's going on, to try and cause us to doubt. Remember that Peter, by all accounts, is the most favorite of all the disciples. He's the most loved. It was Peter that Jesus first called. It was Peter that Jesus said, "Come with me and I'll make you a fisher of men." It was Peter that has the great confession, the first one to recognize Jesus' deity. It was Peter who was there at the Mount of Transfiguration. And it's Peter that Jesus first appears to when he's coming to the disciples after his resurrection. Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 15, he was raised on the third day, and he appeared to Peter and then to the 12. And so of all of the apostles, it's Peter who is the favorite. And in Satan's mind, if anyone can get close to Jesus and anyone can plant that seed of doubt, it's going to be Peter. And so he uses Peter, even without Peter knowing it. And the reason it's so effective to use people close to us is because it's hard to dismiss their advice. We know they're trying to help. We know they have our best interest in mind. We know they love us. And so their advice is more important than that of strangers. And it becomes very difficult then to recognize bad advice coming from people we love. You've probably heard by now this past week, Billy Graham went to heaven, 99 years old. He would have been 100 this year. I heard that over his 70 some odd years of ministry, he preached to 240 million people. A quarter billion people. Now that doesn't mean 240 million people heard his message. 240 million people sat in a congregation or an audience while he stood on the stage. His ministry is probably one of the most successful ministries in the history of the world, and he has preached to more people in person than any other person in history. And so it's very likely, no matter what happens at this point on, Billy Graham will never be forgotten. The most successful evangelist ever. He almost gave up preaching after his first message. He was at the Florida Bible Institute. He was invited to fill the pulpit for a local church. And so he went, and he took some professors and some friends, and he preached his first message, which was probably one of the worst messages in history. It lasted 8 minutes. And at the end of it, his professors, his friends, and the church were telling him, "Give up, buddy. This is not your call. You are not meant to be a preacher." People in his life who were looking out for him, who were trying to help, but nonetheless being used by the enemy to try and doubt his call. Because after 70 years of ministry, 240 million people have personally heard him, and countless millions more have been affected. The Apostle Paul said in Romans 1, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God to save." You see, Satan knows what happens when Billy Graham is released into the world. And Satan knows what happens when Jesus Christ goes to that cross. And Satan knows what happens when you live your life in pursuit of the mission that God has for you. When you live for God, your enemy loses. And he knows that. And so he'll send people that it's very hard to sometimes recognize bad advice having come from. And he uses those people, even without them knowing, to try and cause you to doubt your calling. But if that doesn't work, he'll try and deter you from your calling. Notice what it says in verse 23. But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me." Now, Jesus does not really think Peter is Satan, okay? We need to just get that out of our mind. Jesus knows Peter. He knows this isn't literally Satan, but what it is the voice of Satan. It's the tone of Satan. He hears that, and he remembers back to his 40 days in the wilderness when the enemy went with him and tempted him every step of the way and said, "You know, you're hungry. You could turn these rocks into loaves of bread. If you threw yourself off the top of this temple, the word says that God will send angels to catch you. And so why don't you just go ahead and give that a test? Do something to relieve yourself of this discomfort." And he hears the same tone when Peter says, "Far be it from you, Lord. You'll never have to die. You'll never go to the cross. This will never happen to you." And so Jesus recognizes who's behind those words. Now, in my version, it says he calls him a hindrance. In your version, it might say a stumbling block. The Greek word literally translates to something that springs a trap, like a trip wire. If you've ever watched the cartoons with the coyote and the roadrunner, and how the coyote's always trying to trap the roadrunner, and so he sets up a box with a stick, and if the stick is moved, the box falls, and he traps the roadrunner. That stick, that's the hindrance. That's the thing that causes the trap to spring. That's the snare. And Jesus said that Peter is acting as that to his ministry. You see, if Satan can't make you doubt your calling, he will try and scare you away from it. And so he'll try and throw as much in your way to trip you up as possible. He'll use people you know, your friends, your family, your coworkers, your teachers. He'll use people who live near you, people in your inner circle, things you're familiar with, things that make you feel comfortable, anything at all that he can manipulate in such a way as to trip you up on your mission. And that's what we see happening here. But we notice a few things. First of all, it is possible to receive bad advice in love from people trying to help. You remember Job? You can't think of Job without going, "Poor, poor guy." I mean, living for God and then Satan comes along and just tortures the man. Eventually, his wife chimes in Job 2 and says, "Job, curse God and die." And we kind of laugh and snicker because it sounds so cold-hearted. But actually, there's no reason to believe him and his wife hated each other. He was a godly man. They had a godly home. This was a couple in love. And so likely what we have is a wife who's looking at the suffering of her husband. And she's saying, "There's no end in sight, Job. Put yourself out of your misery because this is unbearable, Job." And what she says is to curse God and die. And so very terrible advice coming from somebody who's actually trying to help. And here we see the same thing happening with Peter. Very terrible advice coming from somebody trying to protect his Lord. Peter wasn't there to derail Jesus. Peter thought he was protecting Jesus. In fact, that was his instinct. And you'll remember when Jesus was arrested at the Garden of Gethsemane, and Peter grabs the sword of the temple guard and swings it. But instead of chopping off a head, he actually missed and hit the guy's ear. And Jesus rebuked him for it and said, "Put down the sword. If you live by the sword, you'll die by the sword." But we see Peter's instinct is to protect Jesus, which is what he thinks he's doing here. So we have very terrible advice given in love by someone trying to help. Second, just because you come to difficulty does not mean you're going the wrong direction. In 1916, there was a man who had an idea he was absolutely positive would revolutionize the world. He saw a need and he had an idea, and so he went about inventing his idea. He drew up plans, eventually had a working prototype. And in 1917, he had that prototype destroyed in a fire that swept through his factory, destroyed all of his parts and his tools and his plans and his blueprints and everything. almost ruined him. He decided he'd go back to the drawing board and start again. The only reason he didn't go bankrupt was because a friend came alongside and infused money into this failing invention. By 1928, he had an actual working model, but nobody wanted to buy it. Couldn't convince a single person to buy this thing. No one ever needed it before. It was big, it was clunky, and nobody could see a purpose. But eventually, he found one person to buy. But that's all the world needed. Because as soon as we were introduced to the machine that made sliced bread, there was no turning back. And now we have the saying, the best thing since sliced bread. Just because you hit obstacles in your mission, in your walk with the Lord, does not mean you're doing it wrong. Third, and this is probably the most important lesson of that verse, if you want to deal with distractions and temptations and things that will pull you away from God, if you want to deal effectively with those hindrances to your ministry, we have to be honest about what they are. In other words, we have to call it what it is. Notice what Jesus says here in verse 23, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me." There's no mincing words there. Jesus is very direct, and he deals with this very directly. He calls it what it is. I had a man one time, a family member, very trusted family member, loves the Lord, devout Christian, give me some bad advice, but in love. And he told me, in church, you should never use Satan's name, or the word sin, or the word hell. And he said that because in his mind, when you do that, you give those things unnecessary attention. And so he meant well, but I told him, with all due respect, I think that's wrong. Because you can't fight cancer if you don't call it cancer. A believer cannot fight sin if we don't call it what it is. The longer we say that it's a mistake, it's a character flaw, it's an oops, the easier and easier and easier it gets to cozy up to those things. And here's the thing, the more comfortable we make that, the easier it is to give in. Hebrews 6 puts it this way, "Put on the whole armor of God that you may stand against the schemes of the devil." You know, one of the pieces of that armor is the sword of truth. Truth spoken in love, truth spoken in grace, but truth nonetheless. We need to deal with obstacles directly. We need to call them what they are. And so your enemy, the devil, your adversary, the one who stands before God day and night accusing us, will try and make you doubt your calling because he knows what it means when you live your life for God. He knows he loses. And if that doesn't work, he'll try and deter you from your calling. He'll throw anything and everything he can in your way to try and trip you up, including using the people closest to you against you. But notice Jesus' determination to his calling at the very end of verse 23. He says, "For you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but the things of man." You know, there's an old saying, "The devil's in the details." And it's usually used when somebody's trying to communicate the importance of planning and getting all the details put together because all the details are so important. And there's value in planning well. But I would say to look at it a different way and to say the devil consumes us with details. In other words, he will get us so caught up, if he's able, in the minutiae of everything that we lose the big picture. I've seen this happen with planning weddings specifically. A member of the bridal party will get so consumed with a detail somewhere. It could be the napkins on the table. It could be the size of the forks or the dinner plates or who's sitting where. It's some detail that derails the whole thing. And before you know it, they have missed the big picture that they're getting married. And here we see Peter does the same thing. He's so caught up in the here and now that he's not able to see the big picture. And so Jesus tells him, "You're not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. You're looking at the wrong stuff, Peter. You're so caught up in the detail, you're missing the big picture." You know, a lot of times when I hear people try and criticize the Bible, they will do it using some detail they don't understand. And it doesn't mean it's not understandable. They just don't get it. And because of that reason, they'll try and bring the whole faith into question. But you know, I've also noticed that when that happens, those people are missing the big picture. They're so consumed on some grammatical detail, some comma or hyphen, that they miss Jesus. Now, I don't know about you, but I'd rather focus on the gospel and live with a few mysteries than focus on a few mysteries and miss the whole gospel. Paul tells us in Colossians 3, set your mind on things that are above, not on things that are on the earth. And so Jesus is determined to follow God's plan for his life. He's keeping his eyes on the prize, on the big picture. He's got himself focused on the things of God and not the things of the world. He's not letting himself get consumed with the minutia of the details to the point where it derails the whole ministry. And you know, we see him do that in his prayer as well. You remember before he was arrested at the Garden of Gethsemane, he was praying to the Lord in the Gospel of Matthew. And he said, Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. But nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. He is more focused on God's plan than the stuff of the world. And that's because Jesus knows something very important. You can't see the big picture when you're focused on a pinprick. Imagine a puzzle for a minute. Hold up a single piece. You have no idea what that puzzle is going to look like. Put it in its place. Take a step back. Look at the big picture. And now all of those little details make sense. Jesus is determined to follow God's plan for his life. He's got his mind on the big picture because he knows that the individual details by themselves are not as important as the overall mission. Paul tells us in Romans chapter 8, God causes all things to work together for the good of those who love God. Notice it doesn't say in that verse that all things just naturally happen to work together for good, but no, God causes that to happen. He takes this piece of the puzzle and that piece of the puzzle and that piece of the puzzle, and on their own, they might be very confusing or isolated, but when they're put in their proper order, all things work to accomplish his greater mission. And that's the mission that we're all on. Jesus is on a mission. He's a man on a mission. It's the name of our message today. And it's a mission that will benefit the entire world. It's a mission that takes 4,000 years from the moment of Genesis 3 to the time that he goes to that cross. It's a mission that fixes a broken relationship. And you know what? God has a mission for your life. Jeremiah 29 says, I know the plans I have for you, says the Lord. He says, plans for a future and for a hope and for good and not harm. You weren't created to go to work and pay taxes. Wouldn't that be a bummer? If that was the extent of God's plan for our life, just, you know, finance the IRS for a while. You were created for more than that. You are not your career. People say, what are you? And they say, well, I'm this. Well, no, that's what you do, but who are you? You're not your house. You're not your car. You're not your job. You're not your bank account. You were created for more than just going through the minutiae of the day-to-day life. God has a mission for you, for everybody. Paul tells us in Philippians, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You have a relationship with God that is unlike anyone else who has ever been created. There is a mission for you. And you will come to challenges. And you will come to difficulty. And you might get some bad advice from people just trying to help. And we take that in grace and we take that in stride. But we understand it will not always be easy. The enemy will try and deter you. He'll try and scare you away because he knows what a person on a mission for the Lord can do. He saw it happen with Jesus, and so he tried to derail that. He saw it happen with Billy Graham, and he tried to derail that. When you come across obstacles in your walk with the Lord, you're in good company because the enemy knows what it means when you live your life for God.